Matt Bubala with you, Radio 720 WGN. All right, now for something completely different. Let's go to planets where nobody is shooting anybody. For now. Till we can get our hands on them and change that. You're in Hawaii right now, aren't you?
Hawaii right now, at least till tomorrow.
So everybody who didn't think growing up to be an astrophysicist would be all wine and cheese, Jason has been presenting in Hawaii this past week. Well, isn't that nice?
Yeah, it has been pretty nice, especially given what I just heard about your weather report.
Yeah, and you recently moved to Vegas. You're now an astrophysicist at UNLV, so you're not going to have to endure the Chicago winter, but you moved right before summer, I want to say. How was the Vegas summer?
It was great. We showed up in July, July 2nd, and went through 2 cases of bottled water and a case of Gatorade unloading the van or the truck.
I'll bet. Was that a bit of a culture shock to get out there and be in the oppressive heat? Because I know they say, oh, it's a dry heat, but I've been to Vegas in the summer, and it's not that dry of a heat anymore. There's actually a decent amount of humidity now in Vegas, and it's pretty stifling.
Well, once you get above like 110, it's hot kind of no matter what.
So that's how you look at it? 115, 110, yeah. What's the difference?
It's pretty much all the same. It'll you dry out fairly quickly. On the bright side, at least your clothes don't get soaking wet.
So you really don't sweat that bad in that heat?
But it dries very quickly as you sweat.
You sweat, but then it's so hot that it's drying. Okay, well, boy, way to look at the bright side, Jason. So you're out in Hawaii right now presenting on a paper on a study that you've done with one of your partners on the Kepler mission, talking about how, this is fascinating to me because you and I have talked many times over the past couple of years. I always bug you to promise me that we'll find life. You never come through on that promise. You never even are willing to make me a promise that in our lifetime we'll figure it out. But you're still there looking. But now you're looking at, this is fascinating because it's different, that in some systems there are two planets that are relatively close to each other. And you're looking at the idea of if those were habitable planets, that they could maybe help each other sustain life.
Yeah, so there are a lot of planets. Now, we haven't actually seen anything, to my knowledge, that would qualify from the Kepler data, but there are planets in the Kepler data that are orbiting much closer to the sun than the habitable zone, but they are orbiting very close together, where their orbital distances differ by only, you know, like 10% or so. And so if you stretch those systems out so that they were in the habitable zone, then both planets would be well inside of it. So it's not much of a stretch to then say, well, if they were both habitable, what other kinds of effects might there be going on in this system that we don't see in our own solar system?
So you've found planets that are kind of close together, but none that are Earth-like planets, none that are far enough away and close enough to really sustain life in the way that Earth can, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we see some that may be habitable, and we see some that are close together, but the two, we haven't seen anywhere both of those situations exist at the same time.
So
if Kepler sensitivity runs out right at that edge, and so, so there's probably tens of millions of these kinds of systems that are out there. We just haven't seen them.
You just didn't have time to get to all tens of millions yet. So if you did find two habitable Earth-like planets hovering somewhat near each other, like this is looking at. And what's the distance we're talking about? About 40 times the distance from Earth, say, that the moon is. If we're looking at these
right.
two planets, if you found them, it'd be about 40 times. So if we looked up in the night sky, because the moon is rather small compared to Earth, right? If there was an Earth-like planet 40 times as far away from us as the moon is, how would we see it in the night sky? Would it just be a large, bright dot, or would we actually sort of say, hey, with the naked eye, wow, that's a planet?
You definitely would be able to tell that it was a planet. You could probably, on a clear night, be able to see land featured like continents and oceans and things like that, or clouds.
With the naked eye?
Yeah.
How cool would that be? I know we're never going to see any of this, so it's, you know, silly to think about, but how cool would that be?
Pretty gnarly thought. I mean, I put together an image of, like, here's what the full moon would look like, and here's what this planet would look like. It would be about one-tenth the diameter of the full moon, but that's something that's easily resolved with the naked eye. And with binoculars, you know, you could see everything.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, that would be. So now, how would two planets like that help each other in some ways sustain life?
Well, the issues that we started investigating, they've been floated for our own solar system. We looked at two things in particular. One of them is the issue with the Earth, that if the spin axis of the Earth were to flop around a lot, it would cause fairly dramatic changes in the Earth's climate. For example, so the Earth is tilted 23.5 degrees from its orbital plane, and that's what gives us the seasons. If the Earth were closer to straight up and down in the orbital planes, then it's likely that there'd be a lot more ice, like we'd be basically in an ice age, because the ice wouldn't be melting over the course of the year. Mm. And so the Earth's tilt is important in our climate. And so if you bring two planets close together, we were wondering, would those planets start affecting each other's spin axis so that the tilt changes on them? It turns out that they don't. They don't affect each other's spin axes in any dramatic way. And that's a good thing. It means if you did have these multi-habitable systems, the climate wouldn't be any worse than it is in Chicago in the wintertime. You know, it wouldn't cause any large deviations in the climate over the course of, you know, human civilization. The other thing we looked at has also, it's another thing that's been investigated in our own solar system, and that's the possibility that life may have originated on Mars, which would have cooled faster than the Earth and would have been habitable earlier than the Earth was habitable. And if life originated on Mars, it could have been transported to the Earth through the collisions of, like, an asteroid hitting Mars, knocking off a chunk of material that had some biological information on it. That travels through space, lands on the Earth, and then it seeds life on the Earth. So it's a process called lithopanspermia, which is a fancy way of saying collision ejecta goes from one planet and lands on the other.
That's fascinating.
So we investigated that in these kinds of solar systems, and it turns out that it's quite a bit easier because the planets are so much closer together. They present kind of a larger profile, and it's easier to transfer the material from one planet to the other, which means if you had two planets that were sharing microbial life, you know, biological information between each other, if there was some catastrophic event that sterilized or killed off a lot of life on one of the surfaces, it may be able to be reseeded through this collision ejecta from the other. So the planets could kind of help each other navigate through the rough times that can occur when there's, you know, the collisions like what killed off the dinosaurs or something like that.
We're speaking with Jason Steffen. He's a UNLV astrophysicist and part of the Kepler mission. When we come back, I want to ask him a little bit more about life on other planets and what he thinks we're going to find as he continues his work. Matt Bubala with you here, Radio 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on Radio 720 WGN. We're speaking with our old friend Jason Steffen, UNLV astrophysicist and man about the Kepler mission to find life on other planets. Or actually, is that really the mission, or is the mission only to find planets that could be habitable?
The latter. It's a mission to find habitable zones or habitable planets.
And you've done that. You've found, right? You've found a bunch of habitable planets, but we haven't found an Earth twin yet, correct?
I think that's fair to say, yes. There are a number of planets, somewhere between 50 and 100 or so, that are in what you would consider the habitable zone of their host stars. But we've not yet found one that's the size of the Earth in that zone.
That's right. We found some that are Earth-like, but like Jupiter-sized, right? Something along those lines?
Yeah, so we found big planets in the habitable zone. We've found small planets that are too close to the star, and where the two coincide, having an Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone, it's going to have to wait for another mission because Kepler's not pointing in that same direction anymore.
Mm. Where's Kepler pointing?
Well, about a couple years ago, it's one of the gyros or the reaction wheels that helps point it and helps stabilize the pointing failed, and the spare failed. And so they had to point the spacecraft in a different direction so that they could control the its attitude or the orientation of the spacecraft a little bit better.
So is it taking pictures of another part of deep space now, or do you need it to? So what does that mean, that you just have the data you have and that'll be as far as you get? Or what is it? What is the spacecraft doing now?
So in the original Kepler field of view, it's a up in the constellation of Cygnus, we got 4 years of data, and that's all that we're going to get in that. Right now, the rest of the spacecraft, the camera and the mirror and all that, work just fine. It's just the ability to point precisely in that particular direction that's the problem. And so now it's operating as a new mission called the K2 mission, where it's pointing at different locations, basically along the orbit of the Earth, also looking for planets and other astrophysics in those different fields of view. So it'll look at a place for about 3 months, and then it will change to another place and look for 3 months and work its way around.
So in the 4 years of data that you did get, about how many stars data can you go through now to try to figure out what the planets are around that star and their properties?
So I think on the whole, it looked at about 190,000 separate stars, and took pictures of them, you know, basically took an image of how bright that star is every half an hour over the course of the 4 years.
So wait, this machine was able to take pictures of 190,000 stars every half hour for 4 years?
Yeah.
Dude, that's pretty good.
A lot of pictures.
No wonder it went out. Yeah, thank God we're all digital now, not processing all those on film, huh? Can you imagine you pull
now
up to
the
1 hour photo mat?
So they have all these series of pictures, and it takes months for some of the largest computers in the world to process all the data.
I would imagine. So you get the data from 190,000. Is a computer going through and saying, okay, look at these because we found anomalies? Or is it just now we have photos on your desktop and you're looking at a monitor and looking at, you know, the photos by hand, like one person looking at them every time? Or how does the data then get disseminated?
So the truth is that there's a little bit of both. In the past, so there's still a lot of refinements to the analysis that are going on. So even though there's not new data, we're still making new discoveries because the data hasn't been analyzed entirely. In the past, they would identify individual signatures, and then a human would go in and look at them and say, okay, this is something we want to follow up on, and they would construct the catalog of planet candidates from that. The newest version of what's called the Kepler pipeline, that's a software pipeline where you shove raw data in and you get information back out, is doing virtually all of the vetting through software. It knows what to look for, where there's like glitches in the camera, or where there's it might be an eclipsing binary star instead of a planet. So most of the Kepler pipeline is fully automated at this point, but there's still some citizen science stuff that's going on. There's a planethunters.org. It's a public website where anyone can go on and it will show Kepler data, and you flag it as interesting or not interesting. And
so you're crowdsourcing it. People can jump in and help out too.
Yeah, it's basically kind of like SETI at home, except it's even more interactive.
Yeah,
where you can go and see these things. And that process has discovered a handful of planets in addition to the ones that Kepler's found.
That's cool. So of 190,000, how long is it going to take to get through all of them? How long? When do you think you guys go, okay, 190,000, we figured out what's out there?
We have a fairly good idea of what Kepler is going to find now. We've analyzed all of the data using some of the older software.
Mm-hmm.
So it has all been analyzed. It just hasn't been all analyzed with all the bells and whistles that have been, or improvements that have been made to the software over the last year or so.
So out of
the current schedule is that it's going to be about one more year to finish changing the pipeline, run it on the data, and then run the computer vetting of the different things to produce the catalog. Then it's going to be up to the other scientists to take that catalog, and this is more what I do, is I take that catalog and I look at what we see there and try to understand more about planets and the Earth and the solar system.
So, Jason, and we got to go. I'm going to be late for the news here, but 190,000 separate stars Kepler has looked at, and only 50 to 100 planets in a habitable zone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important to remember that Kepler only sees a planet when that planet passes right in front of the star. And so the probability of any planet transiting the star at the distance of the Earth is like 0.5% or so. And so of the 190,000, only 0.5% would have planets that transit. Not all of those are going to be Earth-sized, and not all of them are going to be in the habitable zone.
Mamma mia. Well, there's, and the funny thing, so this is just within our galaxy, and this is you looking at, so 190,000 stars you've looked at, that's what percent of the stars in our galaxy?
It's about 0.1%. there are 300 billion stars in the galaxy. So it's, I lied, it's not 0.1%, it's 0.00001%.
So you still got some work to do. So we need to get you a new spacecraft is what you're saying too, aren't you?
That would be great, actually, if you have a new spacecraft that that you can fund.
Well,
there is a new spacecraft that's scheduled to launch in a couple of years that's kind of a successor to Kepler.
How much does that cost?
It's actually quite a bit smaller than Kepler. So Kepler was about $700 million for the whole mission.
That's a chunk.
This one that's flying, well, it's a chunk. It's about something like half a day in Iraq during the Iraq War. So it depends on your sense of
scale. That's a way to look at it. You're right. Okay.
So, I mean, $1 billion is kind of the standard unit in the federal budget, and it's less than that. This one that's going to be launching in a couple of years is the test mission, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a mission that is, it's about $200 million. It's a smaller mission that will operate for a two-year nominal mission, and then it has the capacity to operate beyond that.
Yeah. Jason, it's fascinating. I've got to go, but we'll have you back again soon. Now that you're out at UNLV, the time difference is really good for us having you on the show. So have safe travels back from Hawaii. Enjoy your time there. Don't be wooing all the ladies with your astrophysicist jokes.
It's always a problem.
I imagine it's hard to keep them away. Jason Steffen from UNLV, thanks so much for being with us, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk again soon. I love talking to him. I mean, he's going to find something. He's got to find something.